Well, good afternoon. It's great to see you here as we intend to complete our series on Nehemiah, these rebuilding of lives, with the title today, Staying the Course. And our reading again comes in Nehemiah, this time in chapter 6. It's on the inside of the piece of paper you should have got when you came in. But it's from Nehemiah chapter 6, starting at verse 1. When word came to Sanballat, Tobiah, Geshem the Arab, and the rest of our enemies that I had rebuilt the wall and not a gap was left in it, though up to that time I had not set the doors in the gates, Sanballat and Geshem sent me this message: "Come, let us meet together in one of the villages on the plain of Ono." But they were scheming to harm me. So I sent messengers to them with this reply: "I am carrying on a great project and cannot go down. Why should the work stop while I leave it and go down to you?" 4 times they sent me the same message, and each time I gave them the same answer. Then the 5th time, Sanballat sent his assistant to me with the same message, and in his hand was an unsealed letter in which was written, "It is reported among the nations, and Geshem says it is true, that you and the Jews are plotting to revolt, and therefore you are building the wall. Moreover, according to these reports, you are about to become their king and have even appointed prophets to make this proclamation about you in Jerusalem. There is a king in Judah. Now this report will get back to the king. So come, let us meet together." I sent him this reply: "Nothing like what you are saying is happening. You are just making it up out of your head." They were all trying to frighten us, thinking their hands will get too weak for the work and it will not be completed. But I prayed, "Now strengthen my hands." One day, I went to the house of Shemaiah, son of Deliah, the son of Mehatabel, who was shut in at his home. He said, "Let us meet in the house of God inside the temple, and let us close the temple doors, because men are coming to kill you. By night they are coming to kill you." But I said, "Should a man like me run away? Or should someone like me go into the temple to save his life? I will not go." I realized that God had not sent him, but that he had prophesied against me because Tobiah and Sanballat had hired him. He had been hired to intimidate me, so that I would commit a sin by doing this, and then they would give me a bad name to discredit me. It's a final verse on the back of your sheet. "Remember Tobiah and Sanballat, my God, because of what they have done. Remember also the prophet Noadiah and how she and the rest of the prophets have been trying to intimidate me." So the wall was completed on the 25th of Elul in 52 days. Amen. So the message this afternoon is entitled, Staying the Course, something which we can all too easily fail to do. It's very easy to take our eye off the goal. We can find ourselves in the midst of opposition like Nehemiah, or we can allow ourselves to be distracted by something. And instead of staying the course, we can find ourselves checked. We can find ourselves even blown completely off course by what happens around us. Over the last few weeks on our Tuesday lunchtimes, we've been focusing on this wonderful rebuilding work of God. And by that, we don't just simply mean the walls that were rebuilt, or the rebuilding of the temple, or the rebuilding of the country, but the rebuilding of the lives of these people who were living in the dust, who were just crushed under the weight of the shame that they lived with every single day of their lives, were raised up. And the God who breathed life into Adam breathed life into them. And these dry bones were raised up and they were becoming a people again, a nation again before God. So we've read all about this God in Nehemiah, and we've recognized that that same God is doing the same thing in lives in Aberdeen, in lives in this very room. Lives which have been broken and thrown into the dust, his hands remake. He breathes the life back into us. Over the last few weeks, we've seen that when God redeems a man or a woman, he redeems them in their entirety. He wishes to save all of you, not just a piece of you. He doesn't say that there's a piece of you in there, a soul perhaps, that he will save and the rest of you is to be discarded. He looks at your life and he says, right, let's do something here. For having heard the knock of God at the door of our hearts and having opened them up to him, he comes in. He doesn't just go and sit quietly in the corner. He looks around at our lives and says, right, let's rebuild. Let's remake. Let's renew. And so the phrase, staying the course, it originally came into English language because of horse racing and boat racing, and it was required that you had a certain stamina and dedication to the race, and you'd stay the course, you'd keep on going and keep on going until eventually you complete or maybe even won the race. They couldn't afford to be distracted. They couldn't afford to go off course. They had to stay the course to get where they were headed. Now, I was wondering what analogies I would use to try and describe such a thing. And of course, immediately my mind would turn to the more dramatic ones, perhaps when I was much younger playing rugby, and I'd have the ball in my hand, and I'd have the try line in my eye, and I'd be heading towards it, and no matter who came in my way, I was determined to knock them aside, sometimes successfully, on the way towards the line. I thought, well, but an even more dramatic occasion. How about when I was in a fishing boat in the middle of the Minch between the mainland of Scotland and the Western Isles in a force 12 gale? So that you've got mountainous seas all around you, so that the sky is blotted out with the waves. And you are staying the course because you know that there is shelter in that direction. And no matter how much the waves are buffeting, no matter what is coming, you have got to stay the course, or you will not survive. And I thought, well, that's quite good dramatic illustrations of staying the course. But you know, oddly enough, almost perversely enough, sometimes it is easier to stay the course when things are difficult, when something big is happening, when you're desperate to find, as it were, the lighthouse and keep your eye on it. It's almost, in a way, easier to stay the course when you have opposition like that. Sometimes it's actually harder to stay the course day after day when the normal things begin to crowd around us, when the normal busyness of life comes in to almost stop the rebuilding work of God in our lives. The subtle things are sometimes the more dangerous, the more difficult, as it were, when it comes to staying the course. So instead of an analogy with a moment of bravado, an analogy of the more mundane, an analogy of the of difficult but mundane things, it's possibly more appropriate. Now, that's my little one calling out to me there, trying to distract me, but we will stay the course. We will try and finish what we were doing. I suppose if I wanted to show an example of something which was really quite strenuous and overwhelming, there was one example which really stands out in my mind, as someone at the back of the room today will readily attest to this example that I'm about to give. But one of the things that I have found a real challenge was when I was working as a teacher in a nursery, a school nursery. I mean, I loved working with these little people. We had 40 children in the nursery that I was working in latterly. It was two classes of nursery children put together, 40 children, 40 three- and four-year-olds. If you've never encountered 40 three- and four-year-olds, you are blessed. These 40 little people have absolutely no understanding of patience, hygiene, or personal space, and yet they have a limitless sense of wonder, a limitless ability to be taken up with excitement over a new thing that they've never discovered before. It is a wonderful place to work, although it can be quite a trial. But the biggest trial, the one that you really need to really stay the course, is the daily ordeal, and it is an ordeal, of getting these 40 little people ready to go outside. Now, I don't know if you've ever tried to dress one toddler or one preschooler, but when you're trying to get the boots on and the jacket on and the gloves on and the hat on and the scarf on, times 40, it is one of the greatest challenges that I have ever encountered in life. Because as you're going down the line, you know that everything is being undone behind you. So again, the hat's on these three, and you look around, and the hats are missing. There's boots kicked off. It's very, very difficult. Even when you've got three other adults all trying to do the same thing, it is quite a challenge. And you've got a certain time limit because you've got to get the kids outside. And it is quite difficult, and you've got to stay the course. You can't allow yourself to be distracted. It doesn't matter if the building goes on fire, you've got to stay the course and get them all ready to go outside. And sometimes it is even worse than normal. I remember one example that I'll share with you that really, really tested the result, which really underlines the need to stay the course. Pretty normal circumstance. You've got the 40 children all chaotically doing this. You're trying to entertain them all, singing songs, getting games, as it were, on the go. Old MacDonald's Farm was being given a lusty rendition as we try and get them all to put their shoes on enthusiastically. And of course, there's one wee boy, wee fella just there, and he just can't get his boot on, quite a normal circumstance. So I bound on over. I could bound back then, and I'd bound on over a bit like that. Thank you. You want to take a seat there? No. And so I'd bound on over to the little fella and I'd try and get his boot on. I've had lots of practice at getting the boots on little people. And so I'd bound on over to this guy and we're trying to get his boot on. I could see why he was struggling, because even with my help, we're pushing, we're pulling, but I'm thinking, stay the course, get this boot on, get it on. And eventually, and with quite a lot of effort, we get the boot on and I'm thinking, excellent, fantastic. And we get to the other one, I've got the other one in my hand, I'm almost shaking hands to myself, finally getting his boot on, when the wee man turns to me and says, "Hey, Mr. Hepburn." And I look at him and he goes, "My boot's all wrong, Mr. Hepburn." And right enough, I'd put the right boot on the left foot. I hadn't checked. All I'd been doing was trying to help him finish what he had started. And of course, I hadn't checked. And of course, that's a rookie mistake to make. And so eventually, and it wasn't any easier taking this thing off, I'll be honest. Eventually, we pull the boot off and we start again. And we're pushing and we're shoving and pushing. Eventually, we get the boots on. I'm thinking, yes, result, because the other 39 children, they're not the most patient. You know, and we're really trying hard to try and keep them encouraged. But, and you know, with my smiling and singing and various things, we've kept chaos at the door. And eventually, I'm thinking, fantastic, good, we've got the boots on, we're almost ready, when all of a sudden we get another wee tug. Hey, Mr. Hepburn. These aren't my boots. Now, I'm not known for being prone to anger. But you can probably understand the pressure, you know. You're desperately trying to stay the course. Get them all ready. Get them outside. And this wee fella, he's, after all that, it's the wrong boots. And of course, all you want to scream at the child is, "Why didn't you tell me that before now?" But you don't. You smile, you bite your tongue, and you go, "Oh, excellent." And you get on your knee, and you wrestle these boots off again. And you look up and down the line, looking for his accomplice, thinking, right, so whose boots are these? And where are his? And so at that point, he goes, "Mr. Hepburn." I said, "Oh, no. They're my brother's boots. My mum just gave me them the day." I said, "Right, fine." By this time, we're now on the 100th verse of Old MacDonald's Farm. He's now farming Tyrannosaurus rexes, because I've run out of animals. And eventually, we managed to get these boots back on the child. And I'm thinking, okay, fine. You know, we're trying to get everyone ready. We've got jackets on, we've got his hat on, we get his scarf on, and he's missing his gloves. So now, of course, I make a game out of it. I get the other 39 children to hunt the gloves. We're looking everywhere, high and low. Well, I'm looking high, they're looking low. And then we're looking everywhere for these blasted gloves. "Hey, Mr. Hepburn. I know where my gloves are. They're in my boots." Honestly, the other adults that I was working with, I thought they were going to be sick. They were laughing so hard. As eventually we find the gloves in the boots. And it's just one of those things. It was the thing we had to do every single day. And there were hundreds of distractions. Well, literally, there were 39 other distractions at any one given point. All clamoring for attention, all wanting a zipper done, or a hat put on, or laces tied, or something else. And it was something which was just the norm. It was something which happened every single day. And the thing is, it's the everyday things that help us so easily lose our patience, that make us so easily find ourselves distracted or overwhelmed, to be blown off course, and to forget what it is that we're supposed to be doing. Forget what it is that God is doing in our lives. And we can be distracted all too easily. Hey, Cetius. Staying the course. You know, when it comes to real life, it's sometimes very difficult to stay the course. I mean, if you look at the whole New Year resolution thing and how few of them actually ever come to anything, you know, the promises to oneself, oh, I will be this year, I will be that. And particularly if they're vague, if they're not very well defined, these resolutions are usually broken pretty quickly. But we do not have a vague course set for us. We don't have something which is unknown ahead of us. And instead, it's about knowing the one that we are to keep our eyes on. Knowing the one that we are supposed to look at, the one who had been knocking at the door of our hearts, the one that we opened that door to. It's about knowing him that helps us stay the course, even in amongst the mundane, even amongst the ordinary. So, when it comes to the rebuilding of our lives, we don't have a vague amble, we have a race that we are to run. A race with a racing partner. It kind of reminds me of the Paralympic event where the actual runner, the runner who is to win, as it were, the medal, is blind. And yet has a guide alongside them to ensure that they get to the finishing line. All too often, I think that's what we are like. And it's about keeping to staying that course with our partner, with our guide, with the one who knocked on the door, with Jesus Christ, who remakes our lives. So, when it comes to rebuilding of the ruins, we come to our Nehemiah text. And the goal for Nehemiah is clear. He's going to build these walls. He's going to put the gates in. He's going to rebuild a people. He's going to have a people once again serving God as they are supposed to. And this is despite all the best efforts of Sanballat and his friends to prevent Nehemiah organizing the people, to obstruct the rebuilding of the walls, to thwart the reviving of the nation. Sanballat and those who are seen as enemies have openly and violently tried to stop Nehemiah. They failed. All of the violent attempts that they had have failed. And so, having failed in the blatant, having failed in the openly violent attempts to try and stop them from building the walls, now they try a secret thing, a more intimidating thing, a more secretive thing, with lies and intimidation behind the scenes. So, what we have here in our chapter, we read all about this with Nehemiah, so close to the finishing line, so close, all he's got to do is put the gates properly in. Here we see these officials in the neighboring regions coming in.
What about Nehemiah and Ezra?
I'm about to do Nehemiah. I haven't forgotten about Nehemiah.
What about Ezra?
Ezra, I'm not doing today. I know. It's tough. That's what happens when you teach your boys about the Old Testament. So Nehemiah, here he is. He's got Sanballat and the rest who come, and they are determined to check him. So he does not stay the course, and they're willing to try and do anything. And so they harbor real and genuine threats to him. First of all, they think if we can just lure him out of the city into the disputed territories, we can get him for ourselves and we could deal with him. But he knows what they're up to. He does not fall for it. He does not go with them. He stays the course. He focuses on what it is that he has to do. Okay, go. It seems reconciliatory. Come and speak to us. But he knows full well what it is that they have planned. But then things get even more serious after that, because having failed to get him for themselves, having failed to lure him out of the city, what they decide is to send him an open letter, a letter where people are going to read it, a letter where this threat will spread. And so they say, well, we're going to tell the king of Persia. We're going to tell the guy who's in charge all about you. And we're not going to tell him the truth. We're going to tell him that you're wanting to be a king, that you're wanting to set up things in Jerusalem. We're going to tell him a whole lot of lies to destroy you. Now, that's a real threat. That is something which is genuinely terrifying for Nehemiah. And yet he ignores them. He stays the course. And instead of buckling to the pressure, instead of being scared and being weak, he turns to God and says, please, God, strengthen my hands. You know, words, they can hurt. Words can damage. Words can be dangerous. And it's all too easy when the whispers start to lose sight of God. But ultimately, God is not mocked. I might be on a regular basis, but God is not mocked. And what's amazing is that all the time that these very aggressive approaches are coming, when it's coming at you like that, in a way, it's almost easier. In a way, it's almost easier when you've got something coming right at you, coming to your face against you. It's almost easier. It's the next one that is far worse. In verse 10, one day I went to the house of Shemaiah, son of Deliah, the son of Mehetabel, who was shut in his home. He said, let us meet in the house of God inside the temple and let us close the doors, because men are coming to kill you. By night they are coming to kill you. This was a prophet. This was a man Nehemiah should have been able to trust. In the last verse, we see that there are other prophets who are coming up against Nehemiah. They're coming against him. And these were people that Nehemiah should have been able to trust. And yet, it's tough staying the course sometimes. And yet,
Daddy, yes, buddy,
I have no idea. I'm sure I had a good point that I was supposed to make it that there. That's right. Shemaiah, this man who's supposed to be able to trust him. This is a prophet. This is a man of God, supposedly, that Nehemiah should have been able to look at and say, this is somebody that I can trust. I will listen to what they've got to say. And yet it turns out that this was a man who had been hired by Tobiah. Tobiah, who had so many friends amongst the priesthood, had hired him to lie, to do damage. You know, it's sometimes easier when they come against you face to face. But that one, where they come at you almost like a knife under the ribs, when you're not expecting it, from a place and a person you wouldn't expect it, that is so much harder. And it would have been so easy for Nehemiah to be blown off course, to fail to remember who he was in the plan of God, to fail to remember that he was being rebuilt as much as everyone else around him, and he could have forgotten this and be completely blown off course. And instead, he replies and says, should a man like me run away? When God has given us a race to run, can we really stop? Can we really run the other way? Nehemiah stays the course, even when threatened, even when people he should have been able to trust were coming up against him. He stays the course. And he stays the course partly because, as we see in other chapters, he surrounds himself with good people. If you are trying to stay the course, it is advantageous for you to surround yourself with good people, people that will remind you of the work that God is doing in your life. He partly stays the course because he is so driven to see the work being complete. But ultimately, Nehemiah stays the course because he knows the one that strengthens him, the one that will not let him down, even in the face of all of the opposition. And that is the key. We have to stay the course. We have to see the rebuilding work of God completed in our lives. But we can only do it when we're mindful of the one that we're supposed to keep our eyes on, the one that runs with us, as it were. And so, in the lives being rebuilt by God here, in this place, I pray that you too will stay the course. Let's pray.